From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley says Christine Blasey Ford has until tomorrow morning to confirm if she'll testify before Congress. Ford alleges that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her while the two were in high school. She's called for an FBI investigation of her allegations, something that Senate Republicans say the White House has to approve. We're joined now by NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell in Washington. Hi, Kelsey.
Hey there.
So Republicans don't want to slow down the confirmation process for Kavanaugh. Here's Senator David Perdue of Georgia speaking to Fox News this morning. He's a Republican.
What we want, and I think Judge Kavanaugh would want this too, would be an airing, a clean airing of this new information. He says he's innocent. If the person who has this information doesn't provide it, then I think it's time we face the reality that we need to move on. We've already spent 50% more time confirming Judge Kavanaugh than the last six judges. It's time to get this to a decision.
Are Republicans willing to vote on Kavanaugh if Ford chooses not to testify on Monday?
Yeah, all signs point to Republicans being prepared to move forward, though they could have a hearing without her present. That's something that they have left the door open for. I also think it's very important to kind of put this all in the context of the fact that Ford's letter doesn't say that she won't testify. It raises objections to the concept of the hearing and says that she thinks that it was too fast and that the FBI should be involved. But her lawyers never explicitly say that she won't appear. And I think we'll have a better idea of exactly what her plans are sometime on Friday morning, because the committee, committee chairman Chuck Grassley, has set a deadline of 10 a.m. Friday for her to submit written testimony and a biography if she intends to appear on Monday.
Well, and Grassley has said that the call for an FBI investigation from Ford and from Democrats demonstrates a fundamental misunderstanding of the FBI process, that only the White House has the authority to start one. But there was an FBI investigation when Anita Hill alleged that Clarence Thomas sexually harassed her back in the 90s. How is this any different?
Yeah, this is something that has been the subject of a lot of back and forth over the past 2 days. And, you know, one of the things that people keep saying, Republicans in the Senate are telling me, is number one, both Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas were federal employees at the time of the harassment or the allegation of her harassment. And so the FBI was more involved in that because of it. But we also have this letter from Grassley that was sent to committee Democrats last night, where he says that in 1991, the FBI's additional investigation into Professor Anita Hill's allegations occurred when the allegations were still non-public. And he says that that is just a very different dynamic than now, where the allegations have already been made public. And he says that that's part of the reason that the time for an FBI investigation has passed.
Well, and meanwhile, Senate Democrats are saying, what's the rush on Kavanaugh? And they've accused Republicans of rushing the nomination ever since the start. Here's Senator Jeanne Shaheen, a Democrat from New Hampshire, speaking with CNN today.
This is an artificial timeline that has been set by Senator Grassley, but it's an indication that the fix has been in on Judge Kavanaugh from the very beginning. It started when they refused to release most of his records. We've only seen 10% of what's his background. I hope she testifies. I want to hear her story, but I understand her reluctance.
What about that? What about that reluctance? Why have we not heard from Ford yet?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell at this point because like you said, we haven't heard from her yet, except for this letter that that was released from her attorneys to Senator Grassley, where they say that, quote, while Dr. Ford's life was being turned upside down, you and your staff scheduled a public hearing for her to testify at the same time as Judge Kavanaugh in front of 24 U.S. senators on national television to relive this traumatic and harrowing incident. And I think that that kind of gives you a good and strong sense of what her feeling is about this and what her attorneys are feeling about this.
But Grassley has said that they wouldn't have to testify at the same exact time, at the same table at the same time.
Right. Grassley came out yesterday and told a bunch of reporters that he was offering four different options, both public and private hearings in Washington, and the option of her being testifying behind closed doors to committee staff, or for her staff to fly out to California where she lives to interview her there. So they are trying to give as many options as possible to compel her to participate.
There are people like Senator Claire McCaskill, the Democrat who is up for re-election this year in the state of Missouri, where President Trump won by a pretty significant margin. There have been these Democrats in red states that have been thinking maybe they will vote for Kavanaugh. Does this current situation give them cover to actually just oppose him?
So far, we haven't heard any Republicans announcing any new opposition to Kavanaugh. In fact, we've heard Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona and Susan Collins of Maine encouraging Ford to come forward and to participate in this and have been saying that they support the way the Judiciary Committee is handling things. I think that it is right to say that these red state Democrats are the ones under the most amount of pressure because they are, you know, they have to speak to voters who did largely vote for Trump and have a large base of Democrats who have concerns about this nominee.
And just briefly, where does public support stand right now? I saw a poll that his nomination, the support is just over 30%.
Yeah, it has been falling, but I will say that the Gallup put out a statement yesterday or the day before saying that the public was tilting against his confirmation even before the allegations.
That's NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell. We'll keep watching. Kelsey, thank you.
Thank you.
1 year ago today, Category 5 Hurricane Maria tore through Puerto Rico, leaving in its wake devastation and death. 2,975 people died. That's now the Puerto Rican government's estimate for the months following the storm. Simone Rios from member station WBUR has the story of one of those people.
Cándido Reyes met Luz María Muñiz in a place called Toa Baja in Puerto Rico, and he said he came to love her more than God. He believed it so much, he apologized in his prayers for loving a woman more than the Almighty. Reyes and Muñiz found love late in life, she in her 50s, he in his 60s, but at least they'd found what some people never find.
They were just so in love, and he spent so much time telling people about how in love he was and how he'd found the love of his life. And he kept, like, it was people at church and it was strangers that he would just say, like, he's just the happiest man. And that, you know, he'd found the person he'd been waiting for his whole life.
Debbie Perez is Muñiz's daughter. She lives in the Boston area and recalls how desperate she was for information when the hurricane hit and there was no cell service.
Once the reports started coming in about, like, floodings in Toa Baja, where my mom and my grandma are, that's when the real, like, terror, like, hits you because you don't have communication with them, but you're seeing all these terrible things. They're talking about drownings. They're talking about people who have been caught up in, like, mudslides. And so you start to really fear that something would happen to your family or something has happened and you can't hear from them.
A week passed before Perez got word that everyone was okay, but months passed before electricity was restored in Toa Baja. And 3 months after the storm, Perez's stepfather, Cándido Reyes, died of heart failure.
In the weeks following Maria, the fact that they had to search for food and water, or they had to depend on neighbors, I think that caused a lot of anxiety and stress on his heart. And the fact that walking for miles was not really something that he was supposed to be doing either.
Cándido Reyes is not among the 64 deaths the Puerto Rican government originally attributed to Hurricane Maria. That estimate seemed low to many people in Puerto Rico, including Pedro Adorno, who led a theater company that traveled across the island after the storm.
We hear more than that. We got the feeling. We knew a lot of hospitals were without electricity, people who don't got cancer treatment, people who got kidney problems. We knew. We feel that, but they denied the information.
11 months after Hurricane Maria, the Puerto Rican government changed the official death count from 64 to 2,975.
Maria!
Sabana Seca is the town in Toa Baja where Cándido Reyes died and where his widow still lives.
Maria!
Residents say the majority of people have left the town, either for the mainland or for other parts of Puerto Rico. You can feel their absence in the air. Despite the sound of power tools and fighting roosters, Sabana Seca feels quieter than it should. Resident Marta Maria Hernandez says life isn't the same with so many people gone. Hernandez says people used to walk their dogs and say hi to one another. Now everything's quiet and nobody goes out. Luz Maria Muñiz had said she'd talk to us about her husband's death, but she doesn't answer the phone. At her house, no one answers.
Buenos días.
Juana Alicea lives next door. She says she was in her house when she heard Muñiz crying that Cándido Reyes had died. Alicea says she rushed in the direction of the cries. When she saw Cándido Reyes, he was lying on the floor, taking in his last breaths.
Yo le hice así, yo como estaba así.
Alicia says she brushed her hands over his eyelids and told Muñiz not to worry, her husband wasn't suffering anymore. In a text message, Muñiz's daughter, Debbie Perez, later says her mother had decided not to talk, that she's been staying in bed and is very depressed. Perez describes Hurricane Maria as her calling to become an activist. She started a podcast about Puerto Ricans on the mainland, and after being born and raised in the States, she considered moving to the island for the first time. Then in December, her stepfather died, and now Perez says she's definitely moving to Puerto Rico.
It's a spiritual journey for me because I'm able to go back and connect to my culture and my people and find ways to help on the ground.
Puerto Rico lost thousands in the wake of the storm, but the island will gain at least one with the arrival of people like Debbie Perez. For Here and Now, I'm Simon Rios in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Liftoff, lifting ISAT 2 on a quest to explore the polar ice sheets of our constantly changing home planet.
That's the sound of NASA's newest satellite being launched into space. ISAT 2, or the Ice, Cloud, and Land Elevation Satellite, will provide the most precise data yet on how rising global temperatures are affecting polar ice melt and sea level rise. Helen Fricker is a professor of glaciology at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. She helped NASA develop the science goals of ISAT 2. Helen, when you hear that rocket launch, how's it feel?
Well, just hearing it play back just then re-invoked the excitement that we felt. It was an incredibly exciting, powerful moment for all of us. We've been working on this mission for more than a decade. The concept of the mission had been in our heads, but we hadn't actually seen it sort of on the spacecraft and being sent into space. It was actually quite overwhelming.
It's really powerful. It's really expensive at a cost of about $1 billion. What does it look like and what does it do?
That's right. Well, the instrument itself is about the size of a smart car, and it is a laser instrument. It carries lasers, and the laser will send a laser pulse down to the Earth's surface and bounce back, and it times how long it takes. And it does that many, many, many times, and it will build up a picture of the Earth's surface and basically just keep doing that for as many years as it's in orbit.
And it detects changes in all of these things. So, for instance, in the height of an ice sheet, it can detect a change down to about a sixth of an inch or the width of a pencil. So you get the information, and what does it tell you? What's actionable here?
So what we can do is we can look at where the mass loss is coming from. So, for example, on an ice shelf, you might get greater melt rates along the front of the ice shelf or at the grounding line where the ice is in contact with the ocean. And we can see from that information how fast the ice is responding to changes in the ocean and the atmosphere. And we can, over time, we can build up a time series for every location on the ice sheet and figure out what's causing those changes. So why is the ice either building up or drawing down in that particular region?
So it will tell you about melting glaciers, melting ice sheets, melting sea ice, and much of that contributes to sea level rise. So you're getting a global view of what's happening on the ground in much more precise measurements than what you've had before?
That's right. So on the ice sheet and the glaciers that drain the ice sheet out towards the ice shelves, we're looking at changes, and they will impact eventually sea level, because if we're losing mass from the ice sheet, then that will add to the world's oceans and contribute to sea level. So sea level will rise. That's just like if you have a glass of water with some ice in it, if the ice melts, the level of the water does not go up. But if you add more ice into the glass, then the water level will overflow. So this is when land ice goes off the continent into the ocean. That's what's happening. Sea ice is actually slightly different because it's already floating. So that's like your ice that's in your ice cubes in your glass of water. And when it melts, sea level does not go up. But it has other impacts on the climate system.
And when you have an idea of what's happening, can you do anything about it?
Well, we can parameterize these processes better and put them into models so that our models will be more accurate and predict future sea level scenarios so that we can then send that information to planners for preparing for the future.
Preparing for a different kind of climate and higher sea levels.
That's right. So as the climate is warming, we are seeing changes in the sea level. Sea level is rising, but the ultimate thing that we're trying to get at is how much ice will we lose and how quickly will we lose it.
So the satellite is called ICESat-2. There was an ICESat-1 for a number of years up above. How much more powerful is ICESat-2?
Yeah, ICESat flew 2003 to 2009. It was a single profiling laser altimeter, so it just collected measurements along a single ground track. ICESat-2, the concept is slightly different. We split the beam into six beams, but then there's two beams on either side that form a bit like an outrigger, and it will therefore capture more of the surface.
Helen, you tweeted after the satellite's launch over the weekend that now is the time to start thinking about ICESat-3. And I just wonder, like, what makes you so impatient?
Oh, it's not a matter that it's impatient. These missions take a long time to plan. Like I said, this one was on the drawing board for more than a decade. And just given that ICESat-2, its projected lifetime is between 3 and 7 years, depending on how lucky we are, we need to start thinking now about the next mission if we want to have overlapping measurements. And if we have a gap again, then we might have to come up with another concept to bridge that gap.
So I know that you're really excited, as are other scientists, about the launch of the satellite. When do you start getting information, and what are you going to be looking for?
So we are at the moment waiting for the laser to be powered up and the door to open so that the information comes out. And in about the middle of October, about a month after launch, we should start getting the first data back, and we convert the raw data from the instrument into surface profiles and compare them with surfaces that we know to see if they're giving us the right answer. And that's all very exciting. It's going to be all hands on deck for several months while we work out what these data are telling us. And we really can't wait. It's incredibly exciting.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Helen Fricker, professor of glaciology at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, talking to us about the billion-dollar ICESat-2 satellite that will provide the closest ever measurements of melting ice around the world. Thanks, Helen.
Great. Thank you so much.
You can see an image of the satellite at hereandnow.org.
Demonstrators shouting "Red Tide Rick" at Florida Republican Governor Rick Scott earlier this week in Venice, Florida. They blame Scott, who is also running for a Senate seat this year, for the toxic algae bloom along the state's west coast that's lasted much longer than usual and has been blamed for killing marine life, posing a health risk to people, and costing the state millions of dollars. Blue-green algae, the freshwater version of wet red tide, is also a problem in many lakes and ponds across the country, and health officials only know the basics about what's causing the outbreaks. But researchers at the University of Kansas are trying to unravel the mystery by growing their own algae. Brian Grimmett from Kansas News Service reports.
7 years ago, a toxic form of algae bloomed in Milford Lake near Junction City, Kansas. No one had seen anything quite like it. The bloom lasted for almost 3 months, and it's returned every summer since. The event set state scientists looking for what spurred the blue-green algae, called cyanobacteria, and how to stop the return of what is essentially killer pond scum.
Throughout the years, we're trying to figure out what got Milford going, and that seems to be a million-dollar question.
That's Trevor Flynn. He oversees water quality monitoring for the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. Each summer since the Milford Lake bloom, the department has confirmed cases of toxic blue-green algae in dozens of lakes and ponds across Kansas. The blooms aren't just a nuisance because they look gross. Coming in contact with one can get people sick. Common symptoms include diarrhea, vomiting, and hives. For animals, the blooms can be deadly.
So that's a real detriment to not only the water quality, but for the enjoyment of the people wanting to use it for recreation.
The culprit is too many nutrients, like nitrogen and phosphorus, that get into the water system when heavy rains wash fertilizer off farm fields. But that's about as much as we know, for now at least. About 10 miles northeast of the University of Kansas campus in Lawrence, down a long dirt road, sits the University of Kansas Field Station. It's 3,400 acres and includes about 100 man-made ponds. University of Kansas biologist Ted Harris takes me to one. He's trying to get algae to grow in several large round fiberglass tanks dropped into the middle of the pond.
They're about 10 feet in diameter and then 6 feet deep. But here, we can go check it out.
As we walk down one of two narrow docks that reach into the middle of the pond, Harris explains that researchers generally know why the blooms happen, but they don't know why some blooms are full of toxic cyanobacteria and others aren't.
The goal of this is to see if there's any definitive different sorts of nutrients or proportions of nitrogen and phosphorus that lead specifically to toxic blooms.
So Harris and his team added different combinations of nutrients to the tanks. Some got phosphorus, some got nitrogen, and others get both.
You can see right here on the duct tape, it's got a tank number, but then it's also got three letters. And that's the sort of treatment.
Harris says when the experiment got underway, the water in the tanks was clear. After 17 days of adding nutrients, algae started to grow.
And see, here's a control, so no nutrients added to this one. Looks like you can drink that water. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it, but right, it looks, if you look between this one where we've added ammonium and phosphorus, and this one as a control, really big noticeable difference.
What's harder to notice, especially for non-scientists, is telling a dangerous type of algae from a harmless one.
So is this tank, is this cyanobacteria here?
This is cyanobacteria here.
Because when I look at it, I'd look at this and go, yeah, that looks like...
Oh, you don't want to get in that. Yeah. And this is a cyanobacteria bloom. And so you can just see a little bit of color differentiation. But if you're the average person, you go, I don't know, it looks like pond scum to me, right? So that's why it's always, if you see big blooms, stay away from them just to be safe.
Algal bloom experiments on this scale have not been done before. Usually they take place in a lab inside of a fish tank. But Harris says that setting doesn't provide the natural sunlight, wind, pollen, and rain found in the real world.
This is realistic of what we're going to see if a big inflow event comes with a lot of nitrate or a lot of ammonia or a lot of phosphorus or maybe some combination of those. And this is what would happen in sort of repeated rain events, which is what we get, well, usually, not this year, but usually every spring.
Ultimately, Harris says if health officials and water managers can better understand what real-world factors cause toxic blooms, perhaps they can stop them from happening in the first place. For Here Now, I'm Brian Grimmett in Lawrence, Kansas.
The New York Review of Books has parted ways with editor Ian Buruma because of a decision he made to publish an essay by a controversial figure. The essay was by former radio host Gian Comeschi. Comeschi left his Canadian broadcasting program Q in 2014 after multiple accusations that he had sexually assaulted women. That's one of several controversial articles that have caused critics to question the editorial judgment of the publications that ran them. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll joins us now with more details. John, tell us more about Gian Comeschi's piece that reveals what his life has been like since he became persona non grata.
Gian Comeschi said that he wrote this 3,400-word piece to reclaim his name and to add nuance to his story. Back in 2014, he was accused by several women of choking, hitting, biting during sex. He was acquitted on the criminal charges, but eventually about 20 other women came forward with accusations about him or against him. They didn't make it into the essay, though, that Comeschi wrote, which is sort of a combination of selective memory and revisionist history.
Mm-hmm. But an editor's note did appear on the web later.
There is now an editor's note on the website expanding on the allegations against him.
The editor who published it, we mentioned Ian Buruma, left his job yesterday. The departure came after an interview that he gave last Friday justifying his decision to publish the essay by Gian Comeschi. Slate's Isaac Chotiner asked Buruma about giving a forum to Comeschi, the man accused of sexual assault. Buruma said, quote, "The exact nature of his behavior, how much consent was involved, I have no idea, nor is it really my concern." So what was his concern as editor then?
Well, Buruma says he was looking to explore what happens to somebody who has, in Buruma's own words, not been found guilty in any criminal sense and who perhaps deserves social opprobrium. But how long should that last? What form should it take? Questions like that. He thought that that was a topic that was worthy of exploration.
There are parallels in Comeschi's essay to the one written by John Hockenberry, who hosted the public radio program The Takeaway until August of last year.
Right. Hockenberry, his contract was not renewed. A few months later, a piece appeared in New York magazine's The Cut with allegations that of sexual harassment, abusive behavior by Hockenberry. In the October issue of Harper's, he has a 7,000-word essay that basically says he's just a misguided romantic who's the victim of an overcorrection in society during the Me Too movement. A lot of people, including a number of his accusers, found it totally self-serving and extremely offensive.
Harper's publisher and president Rick MacArthur told the CBC program The Current that Huckenberry's essay is not solely a defense of his behavior or a rationalization for it. Let's have a listen.
It's a complicated mix of atonement, regret, and an attempt to explore sexual relations between men and women in the modern age.
John, is there no merit to finding out about the experience of at least a few of the many public figures who have now fallen quite far because of public accusations?
There is merit. Unfortunately, in these two examples, basically the problem is they're focusing on what happened to these two men as opposed to the actions they took that brought those consequences on. I think the term pity party has been used more than once.
John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst. We'll have a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Nick Bruner is a DJ and host of Hey Listen on Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. He is with us now. Hi, Nick.
Hi, it's great to be both here and now, Jeremy.
Yes, okay, so tell us a little bit about your show.
Okay, my show is a music discovery program based out of Sacramento, California. I like to look at it as about maybe 2 hours a week of really polished sort of college radio station feel on public radio.
And you've brought us a lot of local artists today, people from Northern California. Let's start with Lillian Francis. This is her song, Phone, Keys, Wallet.
I'm filing out my pockets.
Lillian Francis calls herself a sound collager, which makes sense because you can hear a lot of interesting sounds going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because she used to be predominantly an acoustic artist as well. She didn't get into electronic music until a few years ago. She was back working on a farm, and she got tendonitis in one of her shoulders. And she says that because of what she calls an acoustic amputation, she couldn't play guitar. So that, oddly enough, is what gave her the courage to perform electronic music live, and that's where we get Phone Keys Wallet.
And she's from Davis, California. What do you like about her?
But first of all, she's brilliant. She is just full of energy. In fact, the video that we saw for Phone Keys Wallet came out of the NPR Tiny Desk contest from earlier this year. So thanks, NPR, for helping us discover somebody in our backyard. And she's just, her energy is just effusive.
Okay, well, next you have brought us the song Broadway by Poor Majesty.
Raising the rent another 7%. Got every tenant on my block in some state of shock. I once thought grandmama was good here until she got the refi fixed for 4 years. Another scam, another jam to put bread on. Had to be the Lord to keep us here this long, huh? My folks strong, we knew struggle our whole life. We juggled them lemons that we've been given to whole pies. I own the prize cause we destined to rise. Cause every day that I'm given is a pleasant surprise. I might cry looking back at all the blessings bestowed. And thought of Broadway as if it's more than a road. With barbecue spots and black owned barbershops. Cameras on every block while them boys just watch. Hard to feel at home with helicopters. And helicopters over these modern day sharecroppers. Trying to make it on
okay. Okay, so this is obviously not Broadway music, not show tunes here, but it's called Broadway. What's he rapping about?
Well, Adrian lives off of Broadway in Sacramento, and he's rapping about the changes that he sees and how gentrification has been affecting that neighborhood. He's told me that really Broadway could be anywhere. It could be in Chicago, it could be in Baltimore. And that while the Broadway in Sacramento, where he's been living, is becoming a lot cleaner, more appealing, he noticed that really nobody from those neighborhoods has been working in the new establishments, your restaurants, your bars that are going up. So he said he wanted this song to be about the Broadways all over America, not exactly be taken literally in Sacramento, but definitely close to home.
And Poor Majesty is from the hip-hop trio Tribe of Levi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he struck out on his own with a previous solo album called Good God Almighty, and then he's preparing to release an as-of-yet-untitled record later this year.
Okay, now let's go to the group Topograph. This is their song Signs. Nice sound there. A lot of layers going on here.
Yeah, and they're a relatively new group as well. The group is made up of a married couple named Alyssa and Kevin Stefanescu. And Kevin's been in a handful of bands around Sacramento. Alyssa only just started writing music with him after they were married when they started Topograph together.
And do they perform in Sacramento only, or are they performing all over the place?
They're planning on going on tour after the release of their EP, but since they are so new, a lot of their shows have just been limited to the Sacramento region. But their sound is so rich and deep and atmospheric. I love it.
Okay, next is the artist Evil Seagull with You Are Wise. Now, if you Google Evil Seagull, this is what you get. This is a YouTube video of a laughing seagull, but in this case, Evil Seagull is the stage name for Anne Healy. Who is she?
Oh, that's so funny. She is a musician who moved to Sacramento from Oakland just about a year and a half ago. And Evil Seagull comes from the fact that she used to play, well, she still does, she plays cello and piano. But when she was learning to play cello, she made a sound that a friend of hers described as an evil seagull. So that's where the name comes from.
I played cello and piano.
Get out of here, really?
But not anymore. Right. I was much better at cello than piano.
It's a tough instrument.
Yeah, but it's a great instrument. We actually did an entire DJ session once just about cello music. okay, we have time for one more song, and this is the hip-hop artist Brulee with True Love featuring Mia Moore.
Feel like I swallowed some butterflies, you hotter than summertime. I wrote you a lullaby, don't compare me to other guys. I want the prize more than them. Dating's a sport to men, or should I say just to some? Never will play dumb. You could tell the fake from the real as I make drums. Taste like cake crumbs, question my fate, why would I do that? Thought when I moved back, I wouldn't even find love. You on my mind, dub, tingling your spine numb. Hug me with both arms, you know I mean no harm. A proton soap bomb, you think that I wrote on? You think that I wrote on a brick wall with graffiti in the daytime, so calm. No thong, no bomb. Really can't go wrong. The whole song so strong. You think that I wrote on? You think that I wrote on? You think that I wrote on? The skyline with the clouds, the stars as life goes on. Oh, girl, be true love.
Now that sounds like it's almost right out of the 60s.
Oh man, it's what I love about a good hip-hop track. Much like Poor Majesty before him, it sounds effortless, it's full of soul and melody. Brulee is terrific. His newest solo album is called Selfie. He's been rapping in Sacramento for a number of years, but this is his first true solo outing and published by Public School Records.
Now, when you take all of the songs that you brought us today, and they're all from the Sacramento area, is there one style that is more prominent in Sacramento? Because these are of different styles.
Yeah, and, you know, there's been much, I don't want to say hand-wringing, about the Sacramento sound over the last decade and change, but one of the things that I think I like about it is just kind of letting go and not really assigning a sound to Sacramento. There's so much good music of varying genres that come out of here, and people are largely running under the radar until they hit it big and then, you know, take off for L.A. or New York or San Francisco. But we've got more and more people hanging out here, and it's nice. The scene is it's really interesting out here. It's very varied.
Well, I noticed that Jerry Brown, the governor of California, who's long lived in Oakland, actually now lives in Sacramento.
Yes, he does, at least for the time being.
So yes, maybe other people will follow his lead.
That's been something of a trendsetter over his career, hasn't he?
That's Nick Bruner, who is DJ and host of Hey Listen on Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Nick, thank you.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun, Jeremy. Thank you.
And you can find all of our DJ session picks on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We are also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
As we monitor flooding from Hurricane Florence in the southeast, we are reminded of what happened in Colorado 5 years ago. There were floods along the eastern face of the Rocky Mountains. 1,800 homes were destroyed in the state's most costly natural disaster. Thousands of people were evacuated. Now, 5 years later, some of those people are trying to return home still. Colorado Public Radio's Michael Elizabeth Sackis reports.
A group of volunteers helped build a duplex in the small mountain town of Lyons, Colorado. Amanda Anderson moved here 11 years ago.
I was a single mother. I worked three jobs, and I bought my mobile home for $7,000.
Today, she's helping build the apartment she'll eventually move into. Her mobile home, along with dozens of others, was destroyed by the devastating floods in September of 2013. Anderson remembers being woken up by frantic phone calls at 3 a.m. from a friend.
And Sally said, "Amanda, you have 5 minutes." And I opened the front door, and the water was already to the steps.
Some people eventually rebuilt the homes they lost. Others took a buyout from the federal government and moved away. But Anderson and others in the trailer park didn't have options. Their homes were gone, the land was sold, and the water washed away what was left of affordable housing in the area.
A lot of my community is gone.
We miss them very much, and that's where the tears start for me.
That's Danny Schaefer, Anderson's husband. They married a year after the flood. Since then, they've been renting because they can't afford to buy. The average home price in Lyons is more than $600,000. This summer, the couple found out they were selected for a Habitat for Humanity home. The six units are the only affordable housing that's been built in Lyons since the flood. Anderson had held out hope for more. She remembers a town meeting soon after everyone was evacuated.
One of the town administrator people, "We promise we'll bring everyone home. We promise." And to me, it was just like the promise wasn't kept. I watched everyone that I loved, that I lived next to, move away.
The town tried to find more housing options. But in 2015, Lyons voters rejected a plan to use public parkland to build affordable housing for displaced residents. Victoria Simonson is the town administrator.
That was very, very disheartening to people that had lived here prior to the flood that kind of got this message that we didn't want you, we weren't willing to give up a park for you to stay part of our community. And that was a really low point in our recovery.
Simonson says it's been tough to find available land now that more than a third of the town is in a newly remapped floodplain and expensive or off limits to build on. But a developer is now in negotiations to buy a property big enough for 40 affordable housing units. And if the project is a go, Simonson says she'll reach out to everyone she knows who might have moved away or is still in need of a home.
They are accepting situations that weren't there prior to the flood, maybe just renting a room, some new space built in a garage.
Simonson says she wants them to feel part of the community again. But she says it's been 5 years since the flood and that Lyons is now a changed community. There are lots of new faces. She says a fourth of the town's current residents have moved here since the flood.
What won't be the same is the close-knit community. We were about 100 people had to leave Lyons, and most of those won't be coming back.
Like Donna Boone, she's 73 and has owned a beauty salon in Lyons for more than 30 years. The hair company sits on Main Street. The walls are painted dusty pink to match the salon chair Boone sits in. Her business wasn't hit by the flood, but her mobile home was destroyed.
Every time it rains really hard, I still get scared.
Boone bought a new mobile home 30 minutes away from Lyons and commutes to work now. After the no vote on affordable housing, she didn't see a way to stay in town.
It broke my heart because I figured I'd live and work here until the day I died. It seems like the people who are low income are being forced out.
About 30 minutes down the road from Lyons is Jamestown. Its main street is just now being repaved after the flood nearly wiped the very small mountain community off the map. While most of Jamestown has been rebuilt, one property still isn't fixed. Along the creek just past Town Hall stands a destroyed home. The whole front half is gone. Jody Sharp is the owner. She says her home looks like a dollhouse.
You can see inside it right now, into the living room and the bathroom.
Sharp says there's been lots of obstacles that have kept her from moving on. She felt the federal buyout offer was too low, and the money she got from her flood insurance wasn't enough to completely cover the rebuild. She's working on getting a construction loan.
I know for many people in the town, my home is like the last remaining reminder of the flood. And, you know, it's sad for me that it's taken so long to get to the point where I'm finally ready to pour a foundation any day now.
Sharp's home is a living memory of that moment, standing there unchanged. Despite that, she says life keeps moving. Her son got married. She now has 4 grandkids. Her mother died. A lot can change in 5 years. But the thing that's remained constant for Sharp and others since the floods is the hope to return home. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Elizabeth Sakis.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.